Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for joining me. Coming up in a few moments, a little bit of general culture, the Latin of Moore and Fisher, and on a more musical note, a touch of Elgar. I'd like to begin today by focusing on a project launched by the President of the Pontifical Council for Culture, Archbishop Gianfranco Ravasi. One, he asked Monsignor Peter Fleetwood, former official of this office, to take part in. Father Peter sat down with me in our studios a little while back to tell me all about it.
Well, culture's your second favourite subject, I think, isn't it?
You're right, yeah.
So it's also a field of expertise of yours.
Well, it became so. I had that surprise one day of being called to work in the Vatican in the Culture Ministry. Well, it's actually called the Pontifical Council for Culture, but nobody knew quite why. And it was because within the work of the Council for Culture in the Vatican was the work of the former Council for Dialogue with Non-Believers, and that's really my expertise.
In fact, the head of the council at the time used to be the head of the Pontifical Council for Non-Believers, no?
That's right, and the man I replaced...
Cardinal Poupart.
Cardinal Poupart was head of both. The man I replaced was an Irish Jesuit called Michael Paul Gallagher, and he had gone into the council for non-believers, and we had gone along a similar track in our formation.
Have you kept in touch with this council? I believe you've been asked to do something new for them, no?
Well, I always follow what they're doing, and they send me their review 4 times a year. And I'm always fascinated to see how they develop the work they've been asked to do by successive popes. I'm delighted that when I went the other day, Archbishop Ravasi, the new boss, mentioned a thing called the Court of the Gentiles. People that know the Bible will know that the Court of the Gentiles is the part of the temple where the non-Jews have to remain, the non-believers, in other words. The New York Jews would call people like you and me goys, which comes from the Hebrew hagoyim, the peoples, the nations, the non-Jews. And this is a phrase that was used by Pope Benedict in his last address to the Roman Curia on the 21st of December in 2009. And like Archbishop Ravasi, I'm impressed by the image, I must say, because what he is trying to get across is the need for the church to keep a space for dialogue with people who don't belong to the world of belief, but are prepared to engage in discussion, contact, research, dialogue of any kind. And Archbishop Ravasi said, from your past, it seems that you'd be ideal for this, so would you join in? Well, yes, I'm glad to do that.
And what does this project entail?
It's brand new, so I don't think that's been delineated yet. That's for the people involved to discover along the way. But I'm glad that there's officially an invitation to keep that space open for dialogue. Too often in my life as a priest, I've been told that, obviously, being a Catholic priest, I will not be open to currents of thought that are not specifically Christian or believers. That's not true. I think the whole point of belonging to the Christian faith is to make a difference to the world and to bring goodness where you can do, to bring openness, honesty, many other values that non-believers and believers would share anyway, but we have our own background for those values, our own reasons for being respectful towards human life and so on and so forth. And I don't think a discussion between believers is going to convert the world. Believers talking to other people as though they mattered, as though they were important to believers, it was essential. If Jesus says, go and preach the gospel to all nations, I think that partly means preach the gospel to all kinds of people. And some kinds of people don't believe, don't find it easy to believe, have lots of reasons from experience or from other parts of life that tell them not to believe. And if we can't talk to them, it's our loss, as much as theirs.
It's a strange thing. I've often noticed that non-believers have a great interest in religion in general. Would you agree with that?
I think they do. I didn't really know that until I worked in the council in Rome, when all of a sudden, after years of me simply writing about what atheist and non-believers organisations were doing, but never commenting on it, just saying what they were doing. All of a sudden, out of the blue, various people came from countries I had never come across before, Nepal, India, and so on, people saying, we'd like to meet the person who does these reports, because they felt it was fascinating that the Vatican was taking interest in them but not judging them. And that would still be my approach, really. I'm not entitled to judge until I know something very well or some set of ideas very well. And they were surprised. They were simply relieved to be on their radar but not to be cast aside or condemned or anything like that.
Pope Benedict is a scholar, really, isn't he? Does he often speak about culture in homilies or speeches?
Well, I have reason to believe that he, as a German, like me as a British person, finds it instinctively difficult to speak about culture in the sense that would be used by a French person or an Italian. It's a question, I think, of vocabulary and concept linked to our nationality. But he is very interested in culture. One of the most important things he ever did before he became Pope was to engage in a conversation with a German philosopher called Jürgen Habermas. And in that conversation, one of the points he was trying to make, how successfully, I'm not sure, I don't know, I just don't know, but I did read the exchange in Munich some years ago. What the Pope was trying to say was...
Well, he wasn't Pope then.
No, he wasn't. No, he was Archbishop. He was Cardinal Ratzinger. He was in charge of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. But he still kept these channels open with German intellectuals. And in this case, what he was trying to say was, if a religion can't be reasonable, it has to resort to violence. Because when you think about it, if you can't persuade someone and you still think that person has to join you, you have to force them in. Now, I think he was being immensely civilized and thoughtful and thought-provoking by saying a religion, to be a real religion worthy of being called a religion for human beings, has to have space for rational discourse, for argument in the sense of discussion, open discussion. And I have to say this may provoke a strange reaction, that is exactly the point he was trying to make in Regensburg when he was speaking about, he mentioned Islam, he mentioned an emperor and a difficult quotation, but the point that he was trying to make was this, that anything that cannot cope with rational discussion, reasoned argument, has to be violent in the end. Perhaps some people would argue with his choice of example. That's not for me to discuss, but I think the point he was making was exactly the point he and Habermas had been discussing, and in a way it was a continuation of that discussion.
Are there any other particular areas that have struck you in this field of culture during the pontificate itself?
Since Pope Benedict is a lecturer by formation, a theologian, I think the openness to intellectuals is crystal clear. It's sad when you sometimes read in some press reports that the Catholic Church is a closed institution, the Pope has a closed mind. I can't see that at all. I think he's a remarkably open man. And the way he conducts himself in discussions, he can only be described as a gentleman. My own experience of him personally has been as a gentleman. I've always said that to people, even long before he became the Pope. And I think that will continue. He will seek, by treating people with dignity and as, you know, equal partners in discussion, he will seek to bring the joy that he's found in his faith to other people. He's not exactly the same as some of the evangelists that I used to see at work in Britain when I was a little boy. It's not his style. He's much more calm and patient in the way he approaches evangelization.
He's a scholar and an intellectual, but he obviously has a broad cultural background because he often quotes from literature, doesn't he? I mean, one of his favourites is Dante, for example.
Well, I think he's one of those people who's appreciated his time here in Italy. So enormous respect for the Italian cultural history. But also, he, in discussion with a great Swiss theologian who died, sadly, just before he was to be made a cardinal, Hans Urs von Balthasar, Even just reading von Balthasar's Aesthetics, which was an amazingly positive and productive approach to faith and theology, the then Cardinal Ratzinger would have, he would have come into contact with many very beautiful expressions of humanity in terms of literature and sculpture and painting. The cultural history of Europe has been, I think, enormously important to him and continues so to be.
He's very much a European, isn't he?
He is. I think he recognises that. He did say, though, in the meeting with the Curia in December that I mentioned before, the first thing he mentioned was his visit to Cameroon and Angola. It had meant so much to him, and he referred to himself as part of the same family as the people he was meeting there. What struck him, obviously, was how much he and they shared. And that's great to hear from someone like the Pope. And, you know, it came across to me just as, you know, I went to see my cousins, my brothers and sisters in faith, my brothers and sisters in humanity. So I don't think his being a humanist in the European sense closes him to other cultures. I think he just knows where he comes from. He's at home in European culture, but certainly not closed to...
He's open to other cultures.
I think so, yes.
Do you think that the Germans and the English have a lot in common culturally, because the Pope is about to go to England?
Well, I think I mentioned before that we both have instinctive problems with the concept of culture as it's conceived in Italy and France and Spain and so on. But I think it really is a question of terminology. But the fact that we both have that little hiccup is to do with a very pragmatic approach to life, which is shared by Great Britain, really, and the German-speaking countries at the centre of Europe. And I think after the dreadful happenings of the middle of the 20th century, we've become a lot closer. We've had to work to understand each other, and we're still doing that job, and I think his visit will actually move that along for a lot of people who still find Germany a slightly shadowy element of recent history in Europe.
And my thanks there go to Monsignor Peter Fleetwood, former official at the Pontifical Council for Culture, currently parish priest of St. Joseph's Blundell Sands in Lancashire, England. And now I'd like you to join our popular Latin lover, Father Reginald Foster, as he speaks to me of two very English characters. Stay tuned. You know what I found? I found something that maybe you're interested in.
Ah. West. John Fisher. Oh, Lord. West. That's another one.
West Monasterian, which means Westminster, I guess.
Yeah, West Monasteriensis.
The canonization of...
the Blessed Martyrs, Cardinal John Fisher, Bishop of Rochester, and Thomas More, the Chancellor of England.
Okay, in Latin, I'm reading here. Canonizationis Beatorum Martyrum
Cardinalis
Johannes Fisher
Episcopi Rofensis.
How Rofensis becomes Rochester, I don't know.
I don't know how they did it.
Maybe it was
an old Roman name. These are old Roman names.
Maybe Rochester was an old Roman.
Yeah, certainly.
And Thomas More, Tomae.
Tomae More, Cancellarii Angliae.
Why does it start with super dubio? Super doubt?
When they're asking a question.
So
because the doubt is in the next line with the letters here. Whether a commission should be assigned of resuming the case at hand, and for the effect about which we are talking. That's the doubt. Mm-hmm. That it should be undertake once again the case of canonization of these people. And then he goes on, of course, he has to say, you know, yes, of course, but
this was before the founding of our radio station, because this
1930
happened in June 1930.
I see.
The 18th of June 1930.
Very good. Wonderful.
So, inter beatos martyris Angliae, quae gloriosi titulo sanctorum insula appellabatur.
Ah, yeah. Okay, among the blessed martyrs of England, which used to be called the Island of the Saints, with a glorious title.
Was it called the Island of the Saints?
Oh, I don't know. That's what he says. You better look into it. That's not my kind of business. Two illustrious men shine forth like stars.
Stelle.
Stelle, certainly.
Refulgent. Duo illustrus vire tamquam stelle
refulgent. Oh, is that good? Okay, among all the blessed martyrs of England, you see, one in the high degree of ecclesiastical hierarchy, because he was a bishop, and constituted in the Episcopal order, John Cardinal Fisher.
Okay,
the Bishop of the People of Rochester.
Let's move down here. I suppose Cardinal wrote this, no? Someone called Cardinal Laurenti.
Heaven's sakes.
But would this have been written in Latin by the Cardinal's office, or would there be...
Oh,
in those days, you would have been out of a job.
I mean, we do these things every day.
Do you?
I was doing the canonization of, I don't know what, Spanish martyrs in the Civil War, you know, just this morning. So, I mean, these are flunkies, you know, secretaries who do this stuff.
You're a flunky. You describe yourself as a flunky.
Well, yeah, I mean, we just blah, 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 blah.
What's a flunky in Latin?
Oh, it's naquam. Naquam. A worthless guy is a flunky. It's naquam.
You know, it's a strange thing, because at Vatican Radio, we don't have a Latin program, but we have an Esperanto program.
Well, you should be ashamed of yourselves. You used to have a Latin program. Some Jesuit, and he, a Slovenian Jesuit, and then he died, and whatchamacallit, some other Jesuit said, nah, it's the end of Latin. Well, anyway.
At any rate, if you go down the page, it strikes me how they have a little bit of a biography of Thomas More.
Oh, yeah, certainly.
Who was born in London, Londini Natus,
anno 1480. And educated in Oxford.
Oxoni.
Pius Oxonii Educatus. Educated in Oxford.
Why are there two I's on Oxonii?
Because it's what they call the locative. Oxonii in Oxford. Pious from his childhood, and so forth and so on. Praebat fidelibus super abbot Celsia. He was taking the lead in front of all the faithful of his parish in Chelsea.
A man for all seasons.
Oh, yeah, well, yeah, certainly.
How do you say a man for all seasons?
Omnibus temporibus viraptus. Oh, I can say it better than that. You saw the movie and so forth.
Yes.
And his daughters and Henry comes up there.
They speak about Henry VIII.
Daughters go out into the water and say, oh, salve me, Rex. And they address Henry VIII in Latin when he came up on his barge up to Chelsea.
How'd you say Henry VIII came up on his barge?
Up
the Thames, rather than to Chelsea.
Chelsea am venit in vicula sua Henricus Rex.
In fact, in this text, if you turn that page and you go to the first paragraph, they speak about Henry VIII. Paulo post Rex Henricus
Octavus.
Octavus is in the Latin numerals, whereas I noticed that the birth of Thomas More, despite being in Latin, was not in Roman numerals.
Yeah, I don't know why they did that. That's just the thing.
1480. Anyway, my Latin is, as you know, very limited, but I can see that his wife, Caterina, was Iritas et Sacrilegia.
No, be careful. No. Henry VIII, who, while his legitimate wife, Catherine, was still living, Tentaverat had tried invalid and sacrilegious marriage with Anna Bolena. Mm. You see the whole story there. Mm. When he had not been able to obtain the approval of his crime, nor of a divorce, nor of new matrimony, so on and so on, defecit, this is in line 5, he fell away from the Catholic religion and from obedience toward the Roman pontiff.
A religione cattolica et ab obedientia
erga Romanum pontificem defecit.
Et rebellionis vexillum
erexit. And he set up a flag of rebellion.
A flag.
Well, vexillum, a standard. Oh, it's glorious.
Sub.
Well, we write the same thing today.
Sub quo subditos subditos.
Subditos suos cum nefando et credeli sue religion vobis abusu militare coagit. Under which flag he forced subditos suos, his subjects, to fight with a unspeakable nefando, an unspeakable and cruel abuse of his royal power. Ooh, they're glorious.
They seem to dedicate more time to Thomas More than John Fisher.
Although, yeah, actually, Fisher was the most educated man around. Everyone knows that.
There's lots here in italics.
Well, these are all quotes.
Mm.
Well, that's very good and beautiful. Oh, I have to save these things. I mean, I just kind of never thought of doing this. And that's why he says this doubt here at the end here.
Where?
Whether the commission should be revised. And he says, affirmative. Where is it? Affirmative.
If affirmative seo signanda.
Namely that a commission should be designated of the resumption of the case, if it will have pleased His Holiness.
Well, why is that interesting?
I mean, so that was the end of the doubt. Should we reopen the case of canonization for these two guys? And of course, he says, yes, His Holiness considered this a good thing, and so forth and so on.
Who was Pope Pius
the 11th in 1930.
And a big thank you there to our popular Latin lover, Father Reginald Foster, a Carmelite who spent most of his life translating papal documents. That's to say, the Pope's Latinist. Finally, time to join Monsignor Philip Whittemore as he brings us a musical comment.
Have you ever suffered from a thing called writer's block? You've got a deadline for something you're meant to be writing. You sit at your desk and nothing comes. You stare at a blank piece of paper or an empty computer screen and you wonder how you're ever going to get started. It happens to composers too, and it often happened to that great English composer Sir Edward Elgar, especially towards the end of his life. When he was quite an old man, in 1931, someone made a really good suggestion. Why don't you compose something using odd bits of music you wrote when you were young, ideas you never really developed at the time? Elgar gave it a try, and the result was his nursery suite, dedicated to two young princesses, Elizabeth and Margaret, and their mother. Elgar jotted down a few notes about each movement in the suite. The first one, he said, should call up memories of happy and peaceful awakenings. The music flows in a serene way. A fragment of a hymn tune is introduced, a hymn written for little children when the composer was a youth. Thank you. Elgar was about 21 when he wrote this hymn tune back in 1878. He probably wrote it for St. George's Catholic Church in Worcester, where his father was organist at the time, and where he himself became organist 7 years later. It was during this part of his life that he wrote some lovely small-scale church music that can easily be sung by parish choirs today. Some of you may know his fine setting of the Ave Verum Corpus, written in 1887. To go back to that hymn tune which the old man recalled from his youth, you remember he said he'd written it for children. And true enough, the words are an evening hymn written for children by Francis Stanfield. Hear thy children, gentle Jesus, while we breathe our evening prayer. Save us from all harm and danger. Take us neath thy sheltering care. Don't believe anyone who tells you children don't like singing quality music. But it's true that it takes a special gift to write well for children. Elgar certainly had it. Even as an old man, the idea of composing a children's piece, using fragments he'd jotted down over 50 years earlier, gave him a new inspiration. The first movement of the nursery suite is about waking up in the morning. The hymn tune comes in quietly at first, then towards the end it's repeated more loudly and it dies away to a peaceful close. The day has begun.
Heartfelt thanks there once again to Monsignor Philip Whitmore, who's currently working as an official at the Vatican Secretariat of State. And that's all I have time for on today's broadcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now. You've been listening to the English programme of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.